Samir's uncle Samir had devoted his life to science and balked at superstitions, a regrettable heritage, he called it, that used possession by the jinn to explain and treat every ailment, he kept one conviction intact. He believed in the power of the evil eye. Nair was sitting in his uncle's study on the leeward side of a titanic oak desk. They had lingered over a very late dinner, and the musky smell of lamb still clung to their robes. On the other side of the desk, Samir sat smoking a Western pipe, a stubby brown artifact that a British archaeologist had given him in 1968. He blew a smoke stream towards the ceiling fan, which blew it back down towards Nair, and tapped the pipe's mouthpiece on his carbuncular nose. "How was the desert?" he asked. "Good," Nair said, and they fell into one of the comfortable silences they often shared. After Nair's parents had died in an accident when he was a baby, Samir had raised him. He was Nair's father's brother, and the only family member wealthy enough to take in a young boy. The only other option was to let him stay in Palestine with Samir's sister Aisha, who already had 7 children, but no husband and no money. Samir had long ago found a niche for himself working with archaeologists all over the Middle East, analyzing artifacts and training archaeologists to use the latest chemical analysis equipment. Nair remembered his childhood as a series of digs. They typically lasted for months at a time, and he often missed school to accompany Samir to the desert. As Samir had always been too preoccupied with work, Nair had been left to take care of himself. He became a loner, but also an adventurer, even as a boy sneaking off on his own to explore the desert. Despite the independence, or perhaps because he had too much of it, his childhood had provoked an intense longing for a family, a longing that lasted well into adulthood and which, he was certain, would never be satisfied. His deepest fear was that he'd never marry. Parents arranged marriages. Parents had brothers and sisters who had children who needed to be married. They organized the complicated social visits in which a man got to meet a prospective bride, veiled, of course. But the groom could at least study her fingers and feet and learn what he could from those extraneous parts. The best insight, of course, was a thorough study of her brother's face. Samir could provide him with none of these things. There were no cousins to marry, not in Saudi at least. And even if he could have arranged a marriage for Nair, Samir felt strongly that a man should do some living before settling down. Samir himself, now aged 65, was still doing some living. Nair often remarked that the Quran encouraged marriage, saying, "Marry those among you who are single." But Samir always replied with another verse, "Let those who find not the wherewithal for marriage keep themselves chaste until Allah gives them means out of His grace." And Nair couldn't argue with that. That afternoon, Nair had brought some samples from Nuf's body that he had managed to obtain, hoping that Samir could help him analyze the finds in his basement laboratory. Samir broke the silence with a gentle cough. "So, you think the Sharawi girl didn't run away?" he asked. "It's confusing," Nair said. "All of the evidence points to a kidnapping. The family thinks she overpowered the camel keeper's daughter on the estate, but I caught a glimpse of the daughter. She was as tall as me, maybe even as strong, and Nuf was short. And how could she have driven off on her own? She would have had to navigate a whole network of freeways to reach the desert road. She could drive a jet ski, but a truck?" He shook his head. "Have they found the truck?" Samir asked. "No, not yet." "Then there's the camel. She wouldn't have let it go. That camel meant the difference between life and death." He leaned back and sighed. "I discovered the sign of the evil eye on her camel's leg. It looked about 2 weeks old, maybe less. It's possible that Nuf made those lines in the desert, but that would mean that she wasn't alone. She would have wanted to protect herself, and the five lines don't protect you from the desert or the sun. They only safeguard against the human eye.
That's not strictly true, Samir said. Most symbols of protection rely on the number five. Five fingers, five words. Neo waved his hand. Five pillars of wisdom, five prayer times a day. I know the magic meaning of the number. It doesn't answer my question.
Symbols are comforting too, Samir continued.
Perhaps your Shrawi girl wanted that comfort. Perhaps she was afraid. I think the question you want to ask is, who was with her in the desert? A woman like Noof, who was from a good family, would have known only her brothers.
Nea sat regarding his uncle, the pipe, the coif of grey hair and the diplomas that hung on the wall. He couldn't help feeling that he was still a young boy taking lessons from a patient old man.
Can we check on those samples now? He asked.
The lab was an odd mix of old and new. A mass spectrometer stood beside a shelf of decaying books, while rows of vials and pipettes shared space with an iron-plated boiling apparatus that might have been a relic from the Ottoman Empire. Above it all hung a faded poster of Jerusalem, lit at night.
The samples are interesting, Samir said.
He handed Nayer a printout, but Nayer set it on the table. Just tell me what it says.
The first one is dirt.
Yes, thanks.
And manure.
Samir regarded his nephew with a thoughtful eye.
The sample was contaminated by blood and sand, but manure is manure.
So the darkened substance on Noof's wrist had contained traces of manure.
Can you tell if it's from a camel?
Nea said.
Only if camels eat oleander. I found traces in the manure.
What?
They're sturdy plants. They like sand and sunshine, but you probably won't find them in the desert.
So, whatever ate this plant probably ate it in Jeddah? Nea asked.
Yes. In a shady place with little water, Samir replied.
That should narrow it down.
Samir disliked sarcasm and he frowned deeply. It's a poisonous plant, highly toxic. The second sample may be more helpful, Samir went on. I looked at the sand from her head wound. It was rough, almost like gravel, and dark orange in colour.
I didn't see any dark sand in the wadi, Nayer said.
There were traces of clay in the mixture too.
So, sand and dirt? Nayer said.
It seems that way.
One by one, Samir began shutting down his machines.
What's wrong?
His uncle asked, studying his face. What kind of animal eats a poisonous plant? Samir gave the question some thought.
It must have been a desperate act.
The next morning, Nayer stood in the cabin of his boat. Being a desert guide was satisfying. It gave him a sense of community and allowed him to live well. But he chose to live on a boat, which was, in Samir's oft-stated opinion, living like a teenager in a tin can. He had spent the night before thinking about Noof. Now that his dealings with the private investigator were finished, his interest in the case no longer seemed legitimate. But he wanted answers to the questions that were bothering him. Why had she died so close to the family's campsite? If she'd driven out there, why hadn't anyone found the truck? Where had they found the camel? Why did Othman think the camel had been traumatized? Each question about Othman seemed to spawn a dozen others. Were his brothers pressuring him to keep quiet? Was he hiding something, even from his family? Or did he not trust Nayer?
Nayer's cell phone rang. What did you do to my detective?
Othman asked by way of greeting. Nayer heard the amusement in his voice.
He's out of the hospital, but he came by this morning to apologize. He's quitting. I tried to talk him out of it, but he wouldn't listen.
Stubborn guy.
I wish he'd been as stubborn about the case, Othman said. What are you doing right now?
Oh, staring at my wardrobe. "I'm free this morning. My meeting fell through, but I have to buy clothing for my fiancé's trousseau. Jackets. Can you believe it? These days they want jackets."
"Do they come with instructions for handling heatstroke?" Naya asked.
Othman laughed. "And not just one, but many jackets. I think they come with a promise of travel to cooler climes."
"Ah."
"So I'll meet you at the marina in an hour?" Othman asked.
Naya hesitated.
"Sure. That should give me time for morning prayers." As he hung up, he wondered if he was doing the right thing. On the phone, it was easy to pretend that things were normal, but it wouldn't be so easy in person. The jacket bazaar was on the outskirts of town, nestled inside a larger market that sold CDs, cassettes, hairpins and sunglasses. They were in Othman's car, a silver Porsche. They'd been silent for most of the ride. At the marina, Nair had shown Othman the walking shoe they'd found at the Wadi, and Othman had recognized it as Nuf's. The information had dampened both their moods. Othman steered through the unpaved parking lot, tires kicking up gravel and dust, until he found a spot in the shade of an SUV and parked.
"The private investigator told me that you didn't find much at the Wadi."
Nair was relieved that Othman had raised the subject. He explained what he'd learned from Samir, that the sand from the Wadi didn't match the dirt found on Nuf's wrist. Othman looked surprised.
"Did you find anything else in the desert?"
Naya hesitated. "The place was familiar. It was the campsite we chose a few months ago." His remark was met with a long, heavy silence.
"Our campsite?" Othman asked finally.
"With the boulder?"
"Yes, the same one."
Naya watched his face closely, relieved to see it awash with confusion. Othman clearly had no idea how such a coincidence could have happened.
"That's not where they found her body," Naya said.
He explained that although they'd found nothing at the campsite, he guessed the flood had washed her downstream to the place the Bedouin had marked on the map.
Othman stared at the ground.
"You didn't find my jacket by any chance?"
"Your jacket?"
"It's missing. The one I always take to the desert. I hadn't thought it was suspicious until now, but the maps from our last trip were in the pocket. There was also my portable GPS, salt tablets and all that stuff. Maybe she took it."
Naya crossed his arms.
It was possible that Nuf had stolen the jacket, but the person most likely to have used it was Othman. Who else would know about it? Did Nuf typically poke through his wardrobe? Would she have known about his maps? It was an unfortunate irony that in being transparent, Othman had managed to make himself look more suspicious.